Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Wednesday, February 19th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. We have a full agenda, and we have several legislators in the room. I know that both Senator Devlin and Senator Prezansky have other places to go, but Senator Devlin, I believe you are the only witness on your bill. So why don't we start with your bill, and I will open a public hearing on SJR 201. Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. SJR 201 proposes an amendment to Oregon Constitution to modify maximum number of calendar days of regular sessions of Legislative Assembly. It refers the proposed amendment to the people for their approval or rejection at the November 2014 general election. There is no revenue impact on the measure. There may be a fiscal impact. We do not have a statement yet on it.
Good morning, Senator Devlin. Welcome to your former committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. My purpose here today is to begin a discussion about improving the short session. I want to assure you and assure all the lobby that are behind me that I have requested no work session on this bill. In fact, I actually asked for no other sponsors on this bill because I've taken a fair amount of grief for introducing the bill, and I anticipated that. But the reality is I think that we need to actually examine the short session and see how we could actually improve the process, whether that's what's contained in this bill or whether it's actually contained in further discussions. That's the discussion I'm hoping to achieve today. I would like to just take a little bit of time to discuss my history, and it's actually most of your history, actually, with annual sessions. In particular, Senator Beyer, former Representative Beyer, and all of you have been through here through a long time. But my first memory of annual sessions discussion occurred on the early morning of the final day of a session in 1997 when Senator Beyer was trying to do something. I wish I could have pulled it up last night, but was trying to do something procedurally to keep the issue of annual sessions alive. And it actually didn't actually succeed. But during my early years in the legislature, one of my chief people in the legislature that was actually an advocate for annual sessions was my predecessor, Senator Randy Miller. And we co-chief sponsored a number of bills throughout a fairly long period of time. And, of course, they occasionally passed one chamber and didn't actually see the light of day in the other. We all remember, actually everyone here, including our newest addition here, remembers our long sessions that went into August, two of them. And if you think about that now and think about how people think that this session is going too long, remember what it was like to start here in January and end in August. We also remember our five special sessions. One of the other issues, one time when I brought the bill up before the Senate, it had the most symmetrical vote you could ever imagine. Never saw the light of day in the House. It was 20 yes, 10 no. But it was 10 Democrats yes, 10 Republicans no, or 10 Democrats yes, 10 Republicans yes, 5 Democrats no, 5 Republicans no. It's never been what I would call an uncontroversial issue. We all went through our experiment, basically, of calling ourselves into special session in 2008 and 2010. And in doing everything possible to keep our long sessions to no more than 6 months. We were successful in both of those efforts. I think that's one of the reasons why the voters reacted so favorably, actually, when the measure was finally referred. In 2010, when the measure was referred, I chaired this committee. It was an interesting time. We introduced a bill with committee bill, so we didn't actually want sponsors on it. There were no limits in the bill, but there was a framework to set limits, and we started a discussion, which had actually started during all of the experimental sessions before. The Senate bill had set the dates, actually, for 135 days for the, or 135 days for the long session, and 45 days for the short session. And some of you may still remember the consideration of that. We sent that bill over to the House. They changed the 135 to 165. Actually, there was a minority report on the House from Representative Hanna and Representative Garrard that limited the context of the short session. That minority report failed. Their version at 165 and 45 passed. There became a good deal of controversy between the House and the Senate, and for the first time probably in decades, if not in the entire history of the Oregon legislature, I was going to be given, if we couldn't come to a resolution to this, I was going to be given the ability to amend from the floor with unanimous consent. Actually, an agreement was worked out. We ended up in conference committee, and that's how we ended up with the session that we now have of 160 days in the long and 35 days in the short. Oddly enough, we had a very strong vote in the Senate on the first bill. It was 25-5. And with all my respects to the Senate Republican leader, he has been consistent from the very beginning. He never favored annual sessions, and I don't know if his opinion has changed, but when we had to make the agreement with the House to get the bill actually through, the vote total actually fell in the Senate to 19 in favor, and I believe either 10 or 11 actually in opposition. The bill that's before you is not expanding the number of days in total. It reduces the long session to 150 days and increases the short session to 45. Repeating my earlier comment from the beginning of this, to allay any fears here, I have not requested a work session on this bill. That's both for my input to you and actually my input to the lobby that's behind me who have been the people actually coming to me the most asking why did I submit this bill. The very reason I submitted this bill is actually to start this discussion on how we can improve the short session. It took many discussions before we went to annual sessions. I think we have an incumbent responsibility to find some ways to improve the short session. I'm sure you have your own opposition, your own observations about the short session. I will give you some of mine. I think there are too many bills in this session, to be quite frank. There's 280 bills in this short session. And to be quite frank, we are actually being faced at numerous times, not in necessarily controversial bills, but actually in bills that are to some degree complex, of people making choices that they shouldn't have to, which is to actually go forward with a bill even though they're not comfortable with the language in the bill. While this bill would be a modest change, would only provide you about 4 to 5 days additional time in each chamber to consider a bill on both sides, 4 to 5 days additional in the Senate to consider a Senate bill, 4 to 5 days additional in the House to consider a Senate bill, I believe it would actually lead to improvement. I think there have been proposals to limit the session. People have talked about limiting it to budget only. I would remind people that we are not actually putting forward a new budget. We are only rebalancing an existing budget. I have 26 members on full Ways and Means, 38 members in total that serve on Ways and Means in one capacity or another. And to be quite honest, they are occupied with budget issues, but it would be very hard to involve 90 members in a rebalance of the budget. Other issues, I think one of my best memories of a short session was, I believe it was 2008, and that's the session in which our agendas were not actually common, but actually my colleagues in the Senate from the other side of the aisle and my colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle shared about half of the agenda in that session in terms of a common agenda. And I think that was one of the best short sessions that we've actually had. I will leave it at that. Again, I just came here to start a discussion. I'm not asking for, or nor am I contemplating, a work session.
Okay, Senator Devlin, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the senator?
I have a question I think the senator can answer, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Could you help people understand what the term post and go means?
Post and go?
Yeah, it's not something we do in the Senate.
Well, I think you're referring to when we have no notice and we just post and we go directly into a work session for consideration of the bill.
Madam Chair, that is precisely the definition of post and go, as I anticipated the good senator would give. One of the creatures of a short legislative session is that it disempowers participation. We have in the Senate adopted a new rule, and that is another evidence of bipartisan cooperation. And that new rule at least requires a one-hour posting for hearings and work sessions, and a one-hour posting on the OLA system for amendments, which is, I think, a way to inject a modicum of transparency back into the system. But, Madam Chair, the short session really disempowers Oregon citizens because it's impossible to participate when you don't know from one moment to another what will be posted, what might be worked in a work session, what might actually be on the agenda. They're not even, I think, required to let members know before post and go that items are on the agenda. And I don't necessarily find fault with any chamber or members. It's just the idea, Madam Chair, that participation was the objective of a democracy. And the short session does not lend itself very well. And as you pointed out, I voted against it. But I guess my last question, Madam Chair, would be, would you consider a friendly amendment should this bill move forward to work session?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I obviously would depend upon the amendment, but you're on the committee. I am not. I've had bills amended without my consent before, so.
Well, that is precisely the point of the amendment, Madam Chair. The amendment would be to require a two-thirds majority vote on any bill considered in the short legislative session. And what that would do would be to continue the tradition of bipartisan cooperation that we had with redistricting, both the state and the federal level, the grand bargain in our last short session, which was remarkably successful, given the fact that we not only shared the agenda coincidentally, we actually shared the agenda across the aisle on paper. Some people could coordinate. So, Madam Chair, I would be offering, if this goes to work session, an amendment that would require a two-thirds majority for passage for any bill considered in the short session. And that, I guarantee you, would encourage brevity and cooperation. And those bills that could not demonstrate that they were widely acceptable to both parties across the aisle simply wouldn't be a matter of concern because they wouldn't get out of committee. Also, Madam Chair, you wouldn't have to limit the issues that legislators could take up in a short session or limit them even to a number of bills. You simply would have to limit them to cooperative behavior in the legislature. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. I don't know, Senator Devlin, if you wanted to respond to that idea.
Well, I don't want to respond to it in length. I mean, there's a philosophical response to it that that I understand where, Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I understand where you're coming from, but the philosophical response goes basically to the issue much broader than the issue of requiring a two-thirds majority is sometimes I think when we do that, and maybe not in this case, but we actually, our system is all set up on checks and balances, but it's set up on the ability of the majority of the citizens in our elections to rule, the majority usually in the legislature with some exceptions that we've actually referred to the voters and they've approved. I do think there are some other ways to do that might be actually more, that you could get broader agreement on. I don't mean to to actually add any levity to this procedure, but so I can do my usual and say something about the House. I jokingly referred to a way to limit bills, and that is that I think each senator should be limited to one bill, but they have to have a co-sponsor from the other side of the aisle on the bill. And each House member should be limited to half a bill, and they have a co-sponsor on the other side.
Senator Devlin, I'll just point out that there are some House members sitting behind you.
Well, that's just so there's an equal number of bills between each chamber. Because I have right now, I think we've allowed a few of them actually to get hearings. I have 45 bills in Ways and Means out of 280. And I probably still have another 3-4 still coming to Ways and Means.
We'll get busy.
I think Senator Starr has a question or a comment.
Just a real quick comment. I recognize we got folks waiting. I support the aim of your amendment. I voted for the original bill as it came across the Senate floor in 2010 and against the final version. There's no question in my mind that this short session doesn't work very well for all the reasons that you have stated. But what do you expect when you bring legislators to the Capitol except that they're going to legislate? And the reality is that the kinds of issues that we're dealing with in this very condensed short period of time are way more complex than we ought to be dealing with, but that's what we do. We work to find consensus, we work to solve problems, and if we have to do it in 35 days and shut the public out, that's what we are here to do, and as legislators, that's what we want to do. We want to try to solve problems. But the short session clearly, and I challenge anybody to argue this statement, clearly shuts the public out, at least at some level, whether it's in the House after bills come across from the Senate or in the Senate after bills come across from the House. You don't have to respond to that. I appreciate the conversation starter.
Okay. Well, it looks like we've answered all of our questions, so thank you for bringing this to us.
Thank you. Thank you for the hearing, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 203, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution
201.
Yeah, 201. So I just closed the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 201, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 203. And Aaron, would you tell us about this? And Senator Przanski, would you come forward?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. SJR 203 allows judges to teach at the Oregon Public University without violating the Oregon Constitution, allows a judge to be a member of the Oregon National Guard without violating the Oregon Constitution, retains the constitutional provision that allows an employee of a public university or public school to be a member of the legislature, rescinds SJR 304 from the 2013 session. There is a fiscal statement issued on the measure, which is essentially discussing the cost of producing the ballot measure and the voters pamphlet regarding this measure. This measure comes to you from your Senate Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. And I think, members, this looks familiar because we already passed this last session, and I'm sure Senator Przanski will tell us why it's back again.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4. The reason that you have SJR 203 before you is because when we passed Senate Joint Resolution 34 during the 2013 session, it provided for what your committee administrator has put forward to allow a judge that sits in a state court to serve as a professor or instructor at a law school, a public law school, and not be in conflict with the Constitution as it pertains to separation of powers. And at the same time, those judges can also serve in the Oregon Military Department as a JAG officer or some other capacity in the reserves. What happened was after we had passed SJR 34 in this last session, there was also another bill that was SB 270 that modified how we would establish the governing boards for our public universities. Because of the way we now have it set up where you can have commissions or boards that will be actually doing the hiring of professors or instructors or other employees at the university, there is a conflict that has arisen that was not caught during the session. Because the way SJR 34 was written, it was permitting for the State Board of Higher Education to do these type of hirings, and we will no longer have the State Board of Higher Education doing those hirings, but instead it will be the commission or a board that's coming through the new governing boards that we have for our public universities. So the purpose of SJR 203 is to go forward with what was the context of SJR 34. It is also to rescind the current resolution that we have sent to the voters for November of this year, since it would basically not provide the voters the opportunity to really address that issue, because it will be setting up for the employment to be made by a group that will no longer be in that position. It should be noted that when we asked, after this came to our attention, we asked for legislative counsel for their opinion. They gave us an opinion in November of this past year, stating that yes, there was a conflict and a need to modify the current resolution that was going to the board, to the voters in November. At the same time, they found another conflict that was not promulgated through this process. And this goes back into when the voters approved back in the late 50s to allow for individuals who serve in the capacity of teachers, such as at K-12 schools, who currently have the authority to serve in the legislature and still be employed in that capacity, and will be updating the statutes to the Constitution to allow for those individuals to continue to serve and be stand for election as they have been able to do so for the past approximately 50 years. So this would also help clean up the other component that has been on the, within the Constitution that was approved by the voters back in the late 50s.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. So it looks like this is essentially the same as SJR 34 that we passed in the last session, with a technical correction to allow it to be consistent with changes in statute that we made last year.
That is correct, but it does need to be put on the record that the other part that is going to be on there that was not in SJR 34, which more than likely would have been on SJR 34 if we had caught this issue, is what was passed by the voters back, I believe, in 1958, which does in fact allow for individuals who serve as teachers at the K-12 level to continue to be able to stand for election as a legislator.
Great. Okay, any questions for Senator Przanski?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Looking it up here, I'm still a little slow on OLIS. So this will be on the ballot when the other one was supposed to be?
Yes, what SJR 203 will do will rescind the current SJR 34 that we passed in the context and take that out, and we would not have the Secretary of State place that on the ballot in November, but instead would substitute SJR 203 in its place.
Great. That's what I thought. I just wanted to double check. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your question. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Never time to do it right.
And
always
I'll close
time
the
to do it over.
Public hearing on SJR 203. Yes, right. And I'll open a work session on SJR 203.
And Madam Chair, I move SJR 203 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved SJR 203 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. I'll close the work session on SJR 203, and we'll ask Senator Przanski carry this on the floor. And moving right along, we'll go back to the top of our agenda and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1544. And Aaron, would you tell us about this? And I think we have, do we have three legislators in the room? Representative Nathanson, are you also here on this? Why not all three of you come forward? Thank you, Senator Rublin, Senator Nathanson, and Representative Berger and Representative Nathanson for waiting so patiently.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1544 changes membership and meeting requirements of the Citizens Initiative Review Commission, directs commission to establish compensation for electors by rule, eliminates sunset date for commission. There is an emergency clause on the measure. This measure has a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Thanks to Aaron. Please go ahead.
Members of the committee, Madam Chair, for the record, Vicki Berger. I will be brief. I'm next door in the Revenue Committee, and I can't stay for long, but I'm happy to come before you and ask you to consider this small adjustments to the process of the Citizens Review Initiative Commission. Senator Roblin and I served together for a number of years on the House Rules Committee, and this notion of the Citizens Review Commission came before us, and at first, I'll be quite frank, my reaction was, oh, one of those idealistic left-wing ideas. But what was unique about it was the energy behind it and the fact that these people had a good idea and were prepared to really try it and see if they could make it work in Oregon. I think Oregon sometimes is an incubator for ideas that get national attention, and we take it for granted that good ideas get incubated here and grow here and don't realize that this got and still gets national attention because it is a different way of looking at the initiative process and how we get information in a changing environment, how we get information out to citizens about important policy decisions. So I have become an advocate and proponent of this. Our unique Oregon experiment in this, and the bill before you is not major, and there are others who can detail exactly why they need these changes. I am here mostly to say, please understand that we're different in Oregon. We do things a little differently, and sometimes we have a different way of approaching issues and problems, and this is one of those uniquely Oregon innovations that I think we need to value and appreciate and keep going. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, if you'll excuse me.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. It's been great to watch a program develop from an idea to a startup and then settle in and become established and respected. Since the Citizens Initiative Review was developed in Oregon in 2007, it has provided voters with quality and unbiased information about the measures they vote on. You may have seen the results of a 2011 study which shows that over half of all Oregonians read a CIR statement that year, and two-thirds said they found it useful when voting. This is a program that has passed the startup phase. As it settles in and matures, this bill brings about some changes that will just help it in this now matured, developed state. It will help it do its work. So I hope that you will support it. Senator Roblin, I'm sure, will be providing more details. I'm here as one of the advocates and cheerleaders, as Representative Berger was, to encourage you to take a look at this and to please adopt this measure, because I think it will help an already good program become better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Nathanson. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the Rules Committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin, and I am the senator from District 5, who also has you let my chair out, so I have to go to judiciary shortly. So, but I will stay for some questions if people have them. You should have gotten a fact sheet that our office sent to everybody, and I don't know if you just got it or not, but I won't go through all of it. But for me, this has been a mission of love since it came to the Rules Committee in the House, and we heard from jurists who sat as part of the jury on some ballot measures, and we heard their heartfelt testimony about how engaging it was to be a part of the process. And as I heard Senator Farioli earlier say, one of the issues is that we're here and we're about open democracy, where people have a chance to express themselves and be a part of solutions. And one of the things that came across from that early testimony was, for the first time, they felt they were able to answer their own questions and minds about the ballot measures that are up for review, to ask questions, and they took the responsibility of being a jurist very, very seriously, that they knew other people were not going to get the same information they were going to get, and so they asked questions, and they, at the end of the day, made a decision based on that, and then they got to send to the rest of the population in the ballot in an explanation that's going to be in the voters' pamphlet, why they came to the conclusion they did, both sides. So there was a minority report and a majority report. And they appreciated the fact that they got to do that, and that after having done it, they were adamant supporters. So the bill that you have in front of you does a couple of things. We put into place last session a timeline where the stuff we had set would go away. So we needed to get it resolved this year. We originally had put them, this new agency, we put them under the, what's the name of the group? I can't remember right now. Oh, the
health licensing.
Yeah, the medical licensing board or whatever, which made no sense to them or to the board. And we had some conflicts in figuring out how to manage the money, because this group doesn't expect any money from the state. They raise their own money. So that took a while to get figured out. So this time we made them a semi-independent board, and they went forth and found a home at PSU where they could actually do their work. And to me, that's really important. The next thing we did is originally, to make sure that the group of people would watch, the board would watch carefully who, what, when, and where with regard to making sure that it really was independent and was non-biased, they made a board made up of really strong Democrats and really strong Republicans to watch each other, and it worked really well. But as we've developed this bigger and bigger pool of local citizens who've been part of the process, who understand why it works and what it's doing, the new proposal increases those people from that pool to be members of the board, so that they can maintain that vibrancy of the board and making sure that it is independent. It also sets aside this new home for it, and it gets rid of the sunset. So we have a place. It is an organization which has developed and has found a place, I think, in the hearts of and minds of a lot of Oregonians as they read the statements and understand where it's coming from. And I guess the thing that I really have appreciated is the fact that they really have gone about this in a scientific, studied manner. And if you look at the very last research and awards, they won the 2012 International Association of Public Participation's National and International Programs of the Year Awards. And they continue to make sure that all voices are heard. Even when people who don't like it, they've picked a particular deal, don't send the people, they will go out and find advocates on one side or the other to make sure that the jurists are going to get as much information as they possibly can about the issues before they have to make a decision. And I am impressed with the work they've done. I encourage you to read over the history, because I think it shows the dedication that's been engaged in this process for the last number of years. And I would be glad to answer any questions.
Great. Well, thank you, Senator Rebel. And I know that you've exercised a lot of leadership and mentoring and moved this forward. And thank you for bringing the bill forward. Sounds like it'll strengthen the process and make it more efficient, too. And are there any questions for Senator Rublin? Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I want to thank you, too. This just looks like a wonderful bipartisan effort to really improve the outcomes of our initiative process. But I did have a question, because I haven't followed it as closely as you have, but I was aware that early on there were some key groups involved with initiatives that, for whatever reason, decided not to participate.
Correct.
And I'm wondering how that has played out. You made some mention of them seeking out other voices.
There was, I think it was Al Oregon, who had brought a ballot measure last time, and they refused to participate in the process. So the initiative group decided, okay, we'll go out and find other advocates that are willing to speak. And they did it for whatever reason they did. I disagreed with them at the time, but that was their choice. People don't have to come and be on the jury. They went out and found people who could answer to that particular part of the issues. The other side did come and participated in that ballot measure. The jury came to their conclusion, and it, as it turned out, I think they came out with the majority in favor of the particular initiative, even though some of the advocates who actually sponsored it did not come to present their ideas. But again, I think it's Oregonians who get selected from a large pool, state voter registration, who then make a decision that they're going to come to Oregon, get paid the average salary to sit there and be a jurist for the number of days it takes to go over a particular deal, and then make write up a statement at the end of it. So I think they have... they've come head-on to different issues that will come along, and they've addressed each one of them in kind because they have a strong board who says, we care about what we're doing, and we're going to make it work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You discussed compensation for electors. Is that on a per-vote basis? Or?
Yeah, very good, thank you. That when they bring the jury together, they come from across the state, and what the issue is when they raise their money that is going to be used, they tell the they take the average daily rate of Oregonians in general. I think, I'm not sure exactly how they get that. You can ask some of the people here. And they say, if you come and are a jurist, we know it's going to be a difficult thing for you to do that, especially if you come from Ontario or other parts of the state or southern Oregon. And we're going to say, we're going to give you some compensation and travel to get here to be a jurist for the number of days that it takes so that we get a pool that is representative of all of Oregon as opposed to a pool that's no close to where the jury is taking place.
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
I want to point out that that is a bargain for Oregonians since our per capita income in Oregon is lower than that of any other state in the region.
There you go.
Thanks, Senator Farioli. And I think it's important to just emphasize again that no
state money,
public funds are being used for this. It's grant money that is raised through various sources. So.
Yep.
Okay, any other questions? Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Senator Ruffin.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
And we only have one other person signed up to testify on this, and it's Cappy Eaton, if you'd like to come forward.
Good morning, Chair. Senator Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, Cappy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters. You have written testimony, but you've heard a lot of good history this morning. The League got involved with this in 2006 as a concept, and we've been very excited over the last 8 years to watch how it has developed and how important it has become in citizen participation with the discussion about what the initiative measures really do. We hope in the future that we can have more panels than the two we've been having, but it's important that this take place and that it be published, the statements from the panels be published in the voter's pamphlet. And as the evaluations have shown, there are many people who really do read those statements and find them helpful. We also thank Representative Berger and Senator Loveland from bringing this forward and to increasing the number of panel members who sit on that commission, because they're the people who have actually been there and done that and understand the process really well. So we support that. We support the compensation for whatever the commission might receive that will be done by rule. We think that's important. So I'm just here to express the League's strong support for this whole process and the continuation of it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thanks again. And And I don't have anybody else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 1544, so seeing no one jumping up, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1544 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1544.
Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1544 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 1544 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1544, and we'll ask Senator Roblin to carry this on the floor. And I think, let's see, we have one bill now for public hearing and one bill for work session. And since we've got everybody here, why don't we do our work session first, and then we'll go to the testimony on the other bill. So I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1504. Members, you'll remember that we heard this yesterday, and it wasn't ready to vote on because we didn't have the fiscal back. So I'll let Erin give us an update on where we're at now.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1504 expands list of prior violations that prohibit individual from becoming circulator. It amends the time period for which circulator's criminal records check is valid. It permits name of candidate nominated for more than one district office to appear on one ballot more than once. It permits elector who submitted ballot an unsigned return identification envelope to remain on active voter rolls. It resolves the discrepancy regarding day in which challenged ballots may be released to public. It resolves certification date discrepancy for write-in ballots, and it limits prohibition on electioneering to business hours and permits person to show person's own marked ballot to another person. This measure was heard yesterday. We have a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact now on the measure, and we have no amendments before you today.
Okay, thank you, Erin, for that update. And Senator Farioli, did you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1504 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 1504 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And is there a volunteer to carry this on the floor? Senator Burdick, would you be willing to do that? Or
yes.
Okay, great. We have a volunteer. Senator Burdick will carry on the floor, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1504 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1581. And Erin, would you tell us about this one?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1581 directs public universities and community colleges to increase voter registration access and information. It prohibits public universities and community colleges from considering student voter registration status when determining resident or non-resident classification for tuition purposes. You do have a -2 amendment before you today. It allows for official school student government to designate nonpartisan student group to provide voter registration services. It requires that faculty member give permission to allow for classroom presentation, and school provide professional contact information for faculty that has been previously compiled by the school. It requires reminders sent to students to be through email only. It clarifies that registering to vote has no effect in determining students' eligibility to participate in the Western Undergraduate Exchange coordinated by the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education. There is a no revenue impact on the -2 amendment. We do not have the fiscal. They are working on it diligently this morning. You do have a hand-engrossed measure with the -2 amendment, as the amendment did rewrite the whole bill, so it's easier to read that way. And that's it, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And just for anybody who's maybe trying to follow along, either in the hearing room or out in internet land, all these documents that Erin was just referring to, including the amendments and the hand-engrossed copy of the bill, are posted on OLIS, so you can follow along there. We have several people signed up to testify on this bill, so I'll just call them in order. And first, Joe Holliday, Anaya Jimenez, and Sarah Shepard, if the three of you would like to come forward. Good morning, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I currently serve the Oregon University System as Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives. We support this bill, and we support the -1 and -2 amendments. We have robust voter registration activity on the public university campuses, so we don't feel that there's a problem that needs to be solved, but we are also aware of the concern in a world of increasingly independent public universities that there might be a need for some type of minimum bar in allowing voter registration activity on campuses. So we're supportive. We do believe it's important that faculty permission be required, and we do believe it's important that one student organization be designated and not multiple student organizations. That could be pretty chaotic if you had more than one organization, particularly when it came to requesting access to classrooms, and the amendments cover that. So we are in support.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, and please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my name is Aniele Jimenez, Vice President of the Student Body at Lane Community College and Vice Chair of the Board of Directors for the Oregon Student Association. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1581. Before I begin, I would like to note that I am also the Community College Representative on the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, but I am not here to testify on behalf. For 3 years now, I have experienced firsthand the importance of getting students on my campus registered to vote. The impact of these efforts have helped me understand the privilege I have to attend a school who allows access for student groups on campus to register their peers. I can't stress enough the importance of all higher education institutions to allow voter registration access. Students are the rising electorate of the state of Oregon, and it is only imperative that we continue to expand access to allow those who meet the requirements to register if they choose to. Lane Community College faculty allows student organizations to come into their classrooms and engage students to register to vote. As a student, I can't imagine attending a public higher education institution where access is nowhere to be found. University and community college classrooms are the places where students are thinking about and discussing the future of their fields in society. It only makes sense that these are the places where they can be reminded of their ability to make an impact through civic engagement. It is important that as we move forward in the work of the state, the youth are at the forefront of access to engage and take action in their electoral process. I strongly encourage the passage of Senate Bill 1581 so that students are allowed to enter their classrooms and register their peers without any obstacles. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. I think we'll hear from all of you before we open it up for questions. Please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. For the record, my name is Sarah Shepherd, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Ferrioli, and members of the committee. I'm a student at Lane Community College. I would like to begin by first mentioning that, as you are all aware, voter participation is paramount to the democratic process. Any efforts to increase voter turnout is only beneficial to the state and therefore to the individuals within it. SB 1581 would do just that. It would aid students in their efforts to increase voter turnout. I'm thoroughly impressed with students' enthusiasm to strengthen the democratic process here in Oregon through voter registration. The Oregon Student Association 2 years ago registered over 50,000 students to vote, and those numbers are only going to increase. We do not only register students to vote, we educate them on the importance of voting. We remind them that they do have a voice and their opinions do matter. Every now and then, in pursuance of registering students to vote, I come across a student who says, "No, thank you. I do not like politics, and I do not want to vote." This always takes me back a little bit. It could be because I'm a political science major who is engrossed with the political process in student government, the vote captain on my campus, and I really enjoy being an organizer and advocate for students. But the matter of fact is that no matter where a student's interest lies, they are directly affected by the decisions made, whether or not they participate. So they absolutely should have a say in these decisions. And it is unfortunate when they do not believe that they have a say. Many students do believe that they should have a voice and are grateful for the information we give about the voting process in Oregon. The Oregon Student Association is a nonpartisan organization, so that means that efforts put into voter turnout is not to sway students left or right, but only to increase participation so that student voices can be heard. This bill would allow for students to engage their peers in nonpartisan efforts during new student orientation, housing move-in, and during classroom presentations. All of these events happen only 2 to 3 weeks before the registration deadline, so it is a vital time for students to hear about and understand the democratic process. Generally, new students are often first-time voters, as they are just turning 18, and they're not introduced to the process of voting. We have a public responsibility to educate young people to be engaged in the electoral process. Especially since Oregon has a vote-by-mail system, students, being a really highly mobile population, should be aware that they need to re-register when they move. And it has been my experience that a majority of the thousands of students I've spoken to are unaware of that. And I'm happy to inform each one of them, because it means that maybe one more vote will not be lost. Students are underrepresented. I think that is unfortunate, because the future is in students' hands. And this problem of underrepresentation can be addressed by encouraging students to reach out to their peers to register and inform them. As a student who is motivated to reach out to every student on campus, I tell you that it is very disencouraging when administration and staff deny access to student housing and try to push me and out of my peers out of student orientation. I urge you to support Senate Bill 1581. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all for your testimony. Are there any questions? Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Mr. Holliday. Approximately how many students in the system of higher education are out-of-state students?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Farioli, members of the committee, I can get that number for you. It's pretty readily available, but it's not in the front of my mind.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I think it's about half. Oregon schools are very attractive to out-of-state students, partly because even though we think the tuition is very high in comparison to other states, it's not. So we see a lot of students from other states. This question is for the whole panel. If there's an organized student activity to register, will that put peer pressure on your peers to register?
I think
could you just say your name again?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Sarah Shepherd. Chair Rosenbaum and Vice Chair Farioli. I feel like when I personally register students to vote, I'm encouraging them, and I don't feel like I feel like whenever I come across students that absolutely do not want to, I absolutely give them the space to do so. I want to increase pressure in voter turnout, because we need more voter turnout in every state in all of America, including Oregon. So I'm kind of happy to increase the pressure a little bit.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, just a couple of questions. These are technical questions, and I hope you can answer them. Under ORS 260.715, Section 4 and 5, there's some penalties for people who register, who might also be registered in another state at the same time. Just by taking a voter registration card and signing it, that would constitute a violation. What's the penalty for that violation?
I'm afraid I cannot answer that question at this time.
Perhaps our staff knows the answer.
Actually, Madam Chair, I was about to provide. And your staff does know the answer. We just looked it up. It's a Class C felony with a $10,000 fine potentially, just for signing your name. So if you happen to be an out-of-state student and you're registered in your home state and you don't change your registration by canceling your existing registration first and then registering in Oregon, you could be considered in violation of 260.715, a person may not vote or attempt to vote both in an election held in this state and another state on the same date. So if you sign a registration card, that's a prima facie attempt to vote, because you're trying to join the voter registration roll. But if you're also registered in your home state, you could be considered to be attempting to register simultaneously in two states. I guess I'd also ask you, do you know the penalty for registering to vote if you are not an elector of the state of Oregon? That is to say, you don't have citizenship in Oregon, Madam Chair. Do you know what the penalty is?
No.
Okay, Madam Chair, it's deportation. So two of the things that I think we ought to inform students of in our attempt to get them engaged and give them franchise to vote, which I support, they need to know that it is not without responsibility, and the responsibility is to be an elector for the state of Oregon before you attempt to vote. You know, you have to be 18, you have to be a resident of the state of Oregon, you have to not be registered anywhere else in the same election, and you have to be a citizen of the United States. Mm-hmm. So, you know, unless we're telling people that there are that four square sort of test for citizenship and electorship, I think we might be endangering them of either a prosecution, which could relate or result in a felony conviction, which certainly would have an effect not only on their lives, but on student access to funding and a whole bunch of other stuff. They'd lose their franchise to vote as a felon. And also, if folks are here and we've made in-state tuition available and encourage students to matriculate from high school, even if they're undocumented, to our institutions of higher learning. But checking a box could result in a deportation. That is a pretty high risk. So I want to make sure if you go to classrooms and you're encouraging folks to vote, and it even turns into a little bit of pressure, because it's a good thing, that you're not tricking people into a felony conviction or a possible deportation hearing before INS.
And of course, Senator Farioli, the requirements to be eligible to vote are printed on the voter registration cards. I don't know that we would want to single out students and start intimidating them by suggesting deportation when we don't do that with any other person who tries to register to vote in Oregon.
Madam Chairman, I've suggested to the Secretary of State on numerous occasions that we actually print the warning next to the box that you check. I mean, it would only take one line. It should be in the target languages that all the ballots and all the registration cards are printed in, and we print them in multiple languages, but we don't fully inform people. The assumption is nobody checks the rolls, and we've heard anecdotally that people being encouraged to register to vote are told that nobody checks the rolls. That's not true. Those rolls are being checked.
Kate, any other comments?
Madam
I think
Chair.
Senator Burdick had one.
Yes. Yeah, I just want to clear up. I don't have the ORS in front of me, but there is a difference between registration and voting. And if someone moves and registers, my own daughter was in that situation, you don't have to inform the elections division that you don't live there anymore. You simply can't vote there. So for an out-of-state student, you know, I think it's important to let them know that if they register here, they can't vote in both places. But that's different than being registered in both places. So I think the statute, as you read it, refers to voting, not registration.
Madam Chair, I'm not an attorney. I would think registration could be considered an attempt to vote. But I guess the real issue is ballots are received every day on campuses during the election cycle. And some of them are being forwarded by family members in other states. And it seems to me it might be very tempting, if people don't know the penalties, to just vote and return their other ballot.
I think someone who's actually in college understands that you don't vote twice.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, we were told by the Secretary of State that voter participation is low because students don't have stamps. So I don't think you should make any assumptions about what student behavior might be.
And of course, if we want to binding interpretation of these statutes, we'll be calling the Secretary of State's office and the Elections Division to clarify. We won't be able to actually vote on this bill today anyway because our paperwork isn't ready.
Madam Chairman, I noticed that the representative of the clerks beat a hasty retreat when these questions started to pepper. But we'll have to ask the Secretary of State. Thank you.
Can we let the witness respond and then... Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you. Once again, Chair Rosenbaum, to respond to Vice Chair Farioli, I just wanted to mention that, like I said, we don't simply just register students to vote. We more importantly educate them on the process and what it means to do it and how it works. We have registered over 50,000 students to vote a couple years ago, but we educated over 88,000. So that means that every single student that we register to vote, we explain it to them before. We spend a couple of minutes explaining it. The instructions are written on there, and it's when you sign your name, it says it's a felony. So hopefully they're not signing their name when they know they're committing a felony. But we make a point of really educating them and informing them rather than just pushing out for numbers if they're not properly filled out to. We call them, we inform them, oh, this is how it works. Are you sure this is, did you not answer this question because maybe you're not a citizen or, you know, can you please come in and complete your form? We're very thorough about that, so hopefully that wouldn't be too much of a worry for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you very much. Question for Mr. Holliday. I'm a little bit concerned about the language in Section 3. Section 1 of the bill, subsection 3, subparagraph line D. Does that preclude any other partisan or nonpartisan group for setting up, a table in the Commons? Or I 100 years ago or so, I went to school at Portland State University and set up tables between Smith Hall and Kramer Hall, registering people to vote as a member of the College Republicans. I'm concerned that by including that in this bill, that somehow we're limiting the opportunity for free speech for other political views. I'm very concerned that we set up a process here that shuts out a certain any group. And say, well, you know, because you're part of student government or because you're part of some appointed or anointed, quote-unquote, nonpartisan organization, you're going to have the opportunity to go and engage with students where if you have an alternative perspective, we're going to shut you out of that process. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, members of the committee, I'd be happy to. So on all of our campuses, and I won't speak for the community colleges, I think there are great similarities, but I might rely on my fellow testifiers here this morning about the community colleges. But we have a process on every university campus whereby there are recognized student groups, and those recognized student groups are always given access in any of those settings that you're talking about. The concern that I was expressing was about a faculty member being asked by multiple groups whether for permission to come into their classroom.
So, Mr. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, so for what purpose then do you have, basically the line that's at least on the amendments, it's on line 22, throughout the academic term in any non-reserved public space, why is that, and why do we need that in the statute?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, members of the committee, I did not write this, and so that I don't have any ownership of that wording, so I'm not sure why.
Doesn't that limit the opportunity for other groups? If you put that in the statute, you basically are blessing, you know, a certain appointed or anointed or approved, whether it's student government or some other nonpartisan organization that, whatever reason, has been deemed the appropriate. Group at right. as it relates to the administration to do this kind of work in what would be a non-reserved public space.
All right. So, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, members of the committee, but prior to coming to the Chancellor's office, I was on an Oregon University System campus, Oregon Institute of Technology, for 15 years, and I spent the last six of those years as Vice President for Student Affairs overseeing all these activities. I'm pretty comfortable that each campus has a process for allowing free speech and allowing access. It's simply that we have a distinction that we make between recognized student groups that have certain rights and responsibilities and unofficial groups that need to go through a process of requesting access. And there are rules that cover that. And in my experience, anyway, free speech is granted, and that this is not a concern. So that would be my take on it.
I appreciate the response. It's not really responsive to the question about why this particular line's in this bill, and I do have a concern that at least at some level we're saying, you know, in the statute we're going to say a certain organization that's been blessed by the administration is going to have the access to throughout the academic term to any unreserved public space. And we're putting that in black and white. If this bill were to pass and signed by the governor, would be, you know, what's in the statute. And apparently, we're not providing the opportunity for other, you know, non-blessed organizations, you know, that have gone at least through this process, that opportunity. That's a concern to me.
And Senator Starr, we could certainly get legislative counsel to come in and explain. I'm not reading the statute quite the same way you are, but I know this came through Senator Hess's office. He couldn't be with us this morning, so we won't be moving the bill today, but we could certainly get clarification on the effect of it.
So I have just an additional question on another part of the bill.
That's sure.
So Section 2 of the bill, could someone just explain why that's in the bill? What purpose does Section 2 have to do with anything as it relates to registering students to vote at university?
If I may reply.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, I believe it just clarifies that it doesn't affect students in this Western Exchange program to lose financial aid. They pay less than out of state, and this would just clarify that students in that program wouldn't, their tuition wouldn't be affected by it. I believe that's all it is.
Just to clarify, because Section 2 became a different thing in the original bill.
What's Section 2 of the amendment?
Of the amended bill.
Of the amendment.
So this is the section that refers to participation in the Western Undergraduate Exchange and the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Ed. I don't know what those are either.
Explain it to me. That would be great.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Starr, members of the committee, I don't want to speak for this bill did not come from us, but I've been in conversations with OSA and with the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, WICHE. I am the state certifying officer for WICHE, and I'm also the residency officer for the university, so I was consulted on this. I'm somewhat aware of the intent. So WUI is a program where a non-resident from a WICHE member state, is granted a discount on non-resident tuition rates. And that is a voluntary program that five of our universities now participate in. That is about halfway between non-resident tuition and resident tuition. I'm sure this is more information than you wanted, but
that explains it. I understand.
Oh, it does. Okay, yeah, I'll stop right there.
Yeah, basically, if you registered, just the act of registering to vote in Oregon doesn't mean that it impact your tuition basis or your tuition status.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ferrioli?
I just feel obligated, in an homage to the Students for a Democratic Society, which was active when I was a student at the University of Oregon in 1969 to 73. Free speech cannot be granted. It simply cannot be restricted. That just is an homage to the...
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli, for that.
Okay.
You were the last from the past, right?
You may continue to beg the question.
Senator Beyer.
Just a comment. I really appreciate these two young women bringing this forward and being as committed you are to trying to get students registered. Certainly, we don't have enough of them participating and doing their civic duty, so I thank you and I encourage you to continue.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see any other questions for you, so thank you all three for your
testimony.
Thank
you so much for your time.
Okay, we have two more people signed up to testify, Rob Wagner and Janice Deisinger.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rob Wagner, representing Portland Community College. I want to thank the Oregon Student Association for their passion in bringing this bill forward, and make a couple personal comments and then a little bit about the process on this bill. First of all, back in a different iteration of my life in 2007, Senate Bill 951 passed. So we have language and statute around requiring institutions access around voter registration information. And actually, in my personal life at Portland Community College, I'm the staff that works with student government under that statute to put together a very robust student registration plan. It includes emails to students, social media, videos, what students call class wraps, opportunities to meet with students and faculty. So there is a framework, and there's a lot of activity that's already permitted and required by state statute of institutions around voter registration activities for students. The one piece on process I wanted to point out was on this bill. I want to thank Mr. Parker Mulligan from OSA with sharing the Dash 2s with me yesterday. I actually had an opportunity to see them before they were posted this morning for public hearing. So I sent this out, and I got a reply back that I'd just like to read into the public record from our vice president around the Dash 2s, specifically around the electronic requirements. With regard to the requirement that we post on the PCC website or other high-traffic websites during the academic term in which certain elections are held, which elections are specified by the ORS citation? So that would be 246.012. And I believe in looking it up this morning, it would be all elections. So we'd be required to post information constantly, sort of spamming our students when there's any election. So maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing, maybe that's what the state legislature wants our public higher education institutions to be doing. But it would be every single election that's out there, school board, Doc Hatcher, et cetera. Would we have to display the Secretary of State's link for the entire term? It seems like that's also a little bit unclear in the Dash 2s, so maybe working with the OSA we can get a little bit more clarity around that. They say that would seem excessive and inappropriate for the state to require us to do this. Our current practice is to have the link up for about 2 weeks in advance of the registration deadline for big elections. I would not want it taking up that much real estate on our homepage for such long periods of time, especially as we move toward incorporating other paths on our homepage, like new student entry points. And I will say our institution is under a lot of increasing burden around the 40-40-20 and completion and registration. So the final comment she said is, plus, if it's there for so long, would it lose its effectiveness? And what would be sufficient under this language? So I just wanted to get that on the record as we just saw the Dash 2s posted this morning. I look forward to working with OSA and with Mr. Parker Mulligan on coming up with a bill that builds on the work that was done in 2007 around the statutory requirements around student voter registration for public higher education institutions. My final thought would be around, just in general, around mandates for local governments. And if this is a mandate for voter registration and sending students information, I would say why stop with community colleges and OUS? I mean, to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I mean, why not post on every website, every state, local government, K-12, corrections? Why don't we require legislators on their personal web pages to be posting links to voter registration at certain times? Just something to think about. So thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I think we'll hold questions until we've heard from everybody.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and Vice Chair Senator Varioli and members of the committee. I'm Janice Deisinger, and I'm from Gresham, Oregon. I sent you my testimony earlier. I hope you all got it. I just wanted to point out, well, first of all, I'm very excited when any young person wants to get involved and take on their civic duties to become registered to vote. And for the numbers of students that are out of state, they can be encouraged to continue to vote absent in their hometown if that's where their permanent home is. And we don't want to encourage them to vote in two places, as Senator Farioli pointed out. I gave you the copy of the cross-state voter check, which showed that Oregon has people registered in at least 26
I don't know if it's 26 or 27 states that are participating in that study that I gave you, but there were 115,000 people registered in Oregon that were registered also in those states, and they didn't include our neighboring states or California. So there's a lot of people that are registered in more than one place. So that can be confusing to young people when you're directing them from a place of authority to get registered here, and I just want to make sure that we send a clear message to our students. That would be just so frustrating to find that you've committed a felon when you were just trying to do what you thought was a good thing. The other point that I wanted to bring out, well, I also gave you the Pew research study that showed that 1 in 8 voter registration was flawed. So we don't want to contribute to that. We want to make sure that we're clarifying people to vote in the appropriate place so that their registration is current and our voter rolls can be accurate. I agree too that if we really pressure these young people every class, every term, everywhere they look, they may just start rolling their eyes and say, and tune out. So I'm a little concerned about that as well. The Section 2 of the original bill, I just want to make sure that we are consistent with our students when they applied for college, that as an out-of-state student, as an in-state student, that matches their voter registration. It should be consistent. We should be putting in place laws that make sense and are consistent, not just to help vulnerable to people who would game the situation in for whatever reasons. So I would appreciate it if you would take out Section 2 of the original bill, and I would urge you to not pass the Dash 2 amendment. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And Senator Starr?
Yeah, Rob, thank you for your testimony. Same question that I asked Mr. Holliday. As it relates to that one line, it just seems limiting to me that the administration is going to say this particular group has the blessing of the administration to utilize these kind of unrestricted, unreserved space on campus. Does that cause any concern to you that is in the bill?
Well, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, as I read that language, and I wasn't responsible, again, for developing the Dash 2, so I don't know, but it looks permissive, so it looks like you would at least have to require student government or, access, but then additional groups, and I was responsible for some voter registration that was a little more partisan in my day back in Portland State, but that was permitted, but it wasn't officially sort of blessed by, by the student government, by the administration. So the way that I would read that and interpret that is that we would work continually, similar to how we do with Senate Bill 951, is that we would work with the recognized student government, and here is my savior coming to testify about the amendment. That it would be permissive, and we would be able to work continually like we do under Senate Bill 951 with the recognized student group to develop access to voter registration opportunities.
Thank you. Can I follow up?
Sure.
So having the beauty of the internet in front of me, I pulled up the Senate Bill 951 from 2007 and happened to not vote for that bill at that moment, way back when, but it did pass. And as I read the bill, there's a number of mandates, strict requirements on the universities and community colleges to do a whole list of things. It's probably why I voted against it, because I'm not supporting mandates on universities. I'm assuming that since the legislature passed it and the governor signed it, that universities across the state are doing it. Does that make this bill really necessary? As I read the requirements in statute today, it seems like there's a whole lot going on at universities today as it relates to voter registration.
You want to
go for it at Mark State Association.
Well, John Wyckoff, Legislative Director for the Oregon Community College Association, Senator Rosenbaum, members of the committee. If I may just very quickly back up, because I'm probably part of the reason that the language that you're looking at is in there, and the reason for that was, in looking at the original version of the bill, one of the comments I made to the Student Association was, if you're going to sort of try to mandate that a student group get to come into every new student orientation, we can't have it be, as I had read the original bill, every student group can come in and say, I want to come into your orientation. You could overwhelm a student orientation that way. And so our attempt was to say, a group can come in. We're neutral on who that would be. We would want it to be a nonpartisan group. Hopefully, if they have a right to come into one of our orientations, we would want it to be, we would hope it would be a nonpartisan group. But the attempt was to make it so that these wouldn't be overwhelmed, as it was going to be a mandate. It may have been inartfully done and maybe needs some work, but that was all that we were trying to attempt to do there, was to make it so that as it was going to be a mandate, we didn't want it to be overwhelmed by any group can come in and say, I'm going to shut this down. All we're going to do today is voter registration with every student group on campus. So that was sort of the attempt there. But I think it got. I think that definition, it sounds like it got used in other areas, because I think in open spaces, I mean, we have very little opinion on who gets. I mean, it should be as open as possible.
I don't know if this bill is going to move forward or not, but I don't know that we need to have that line in the bill as it currently is in the bill. But I mean, the question for you is the same question that Rob dodged. Is this bill necessary based on the passage of Senate Bill 951 in 2007, and this whole list of requirements and mandates on community colleges? So you can speak for community colleges. I wouldn't ask you to speak for universities, but I'm guessing that the community colleges are doing a whole lot of stuff to get students at the community college levels registered to vote.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, I think that we've, there are current requirements that we are fulfilling. But I mean, what I will say, my dodge is going to be, is I think that's a question for the Student Association, because they're the ones working on campuses, working to do this. And this bill is here because they feel that they need further access. I think that you would hear from our folks on campuses that they're doing everything they can to make sure that it's accessible for students to be able to vote. And I think the Student Association feels that you want to go a step beyond accessible and move towards something that's kind of more proactive. I think from the perspective of our local boards, we want to make sure that it's accessible and students know that they have that option and that it's available, and we feel we're doing a good job of that.
Great. Thank you. Very nicely
dodged.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Starr. Any other questions?
Yeah,
Senator,
I just want to follow up with Mr. Wyckoff and Mr. Wagner. Are we doing enough to make sure that students understand the responsibilities and what happens if those are violated? Are we letting them know that there's a right here to exercise your right to vote and your franchise, but there's also responsibilities and penalties for failures?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli. I mean, I think under our current paradigm, where we're making sure students have that available, I think yes. I think that the question that you all have to decide is, if you take that sort of a step further, do you need further protections in place? To get specifically, what are we doing to make sure students know, I'd have to go back and ask our campuses what their practices are. I honestly don't know what specifically would be in place beyond making sure that they have available the information to register to vote.
And Madam Chair, I can hardly wait for students to understand that the administration is the only group on campus that can offer a sanction for a specific group to do voter registration. That to me just seems like a great opportunity to interact with students on a one-to-one kind of basis on a free speech issue. So I'll be interested to watch how that plays out.
Well, and of course the testimony that we haven't gotten is legislative counsel about what that language actually does, but I think the testimony we've just heard is that this bill would not in any way limit the ability of other groups to do voter registration, but I don't know that you would want to sanction, political parties or people volunteering for organizations that might not be particularly popular and give them some kind of stamp of approval. So,
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. That's the way under the best circumstances. But I guess I can see a group of folks who are sanctioned in a student organization attending a political or attending a student orientation with the intent to register folks to vote, and another organization that is not sanctioned making the same request and being rebuffed. So I think that's at the point where you'll see the intersection between freedom of speech access and who has the authority to authorize. And you know, I just relish those opportunities. I think that's a learning curve for students to see who actually controls the campus. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I don't see any other questions, so thank you all for your testimony. And I will close. Is there anyone else here to testify on SB 1581 today? We don't have anyone else signed up. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1581. And that completes our agenda for today, members, and for the week. Although, stay tuned, we are on 1 hour notice. And with nothing further to come before us, we're adjourned. And with nothing further to come before us, we're adjourned.